Hello and welcome to this week's Pip to Asia programme. My name is John Harrison. Now, something is quietly brewing between the Eurasian Economic Union, EEU, which is an economic union of states located in Central and Northern Eurasia, Kazakhstan, Russia, Belarus, Kyrgyzstan, Armenia, and the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, comprised of Brunei, Cambodia, Indonesia, Laos, Malaysia, Myanmar, Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam. In time, a free trade association agreement could be signed between these two blocks of countries. Now, this could have major implications not only on world trade, but basically the whole geopolitical situation of the right hand, I call it, the Asian part of the planet. Very significant potential development. To talk about this, I welcome to the studio somebody who knows all about it, I hope. His name is Paul Gonchurov. He's an American businessman living in Moscow. Welcome to the program, Paul.
Thank you very much, John.
Now, for those listeners who perhaps aren't actually clear what we're talking about, you know, what is the EEU? I think people get the EEU mixed up with the EU, and they are two different things. Could you please, in a few words, just tell us what the EEU is?
Well, the EEU is the Eurasian Economic Union.
Right.
Where the confusion might arise is that before the EU, the European Union, was formed, there was the EEU, which was the European Economic Union.
Right.
And this was mostly trade, commerce, customs, a number of economic agreements. It was not political. It evolved into a political EU, and the result is as we see it today. The EEU today in 2018 is the Eurasian Economic Union,
right,
which, as you described, contains a number of countries, Russia, Belarus, etc., that have these economic interests together for export, for trade development, investment, and so on, practical items, non-political. Same for ASEAN, the association.
So just going to ask you a question then about the EEU. Is this a sort of continuation then of what we used to be called in the Soviet Union? There was a Comecon bloc, wasn't there? And then that stopped. There were satellite countries around, you know, the Soviet Union. And then there was, I think, attempts to form, to reintegrate some of the countries which are located on the so-called territory of the Soviet Union, the ex-Soviet Union. Is this then a sort of attempt to carry on with the previous Soviet trading bloc and in the new economic conditions of today?
Well, yes, territorially and in terms of membership, yeah. These are countries that split off from the Soviet Union when the Soviet Union imploded. But due to history, due to relations and integration, it became obvious that some sort of a trading bloc was in everyone's interest to establish. The fly in the ointment, as always in any grouping like this, is political. It's not economic.
Right.
And this was the fly in the ointment that broke up the EEU, that broke up the EEU as it became the EU. They introduced the political aspect. I don't see that happening with today's Eurasian Economic Union, although Ukraine was a part of it until they demonstrably left. That's in their interests, no doubt. Ukraine is a practical place.
And before we move on then to explaining and finding out what ASEAN is, again, that point about Ukraine leaving the EU, is that because it's an either-or situation that you can't be a member of the EU or trade with the EU if you are an EU country? Which is getting tongue twister stuff, isn't it? Let's say that again. Can you be a member of the European Union and also be a member of the Eurasian Economic Union, or is it one or the other?
Well, today it really is pretty much one or the other.
It's one or the other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's been politically polarized.
Yeah.
And Ukraine, if we're going to talk about that, it's neither fish nor fowl right now because it's not a member of the EU, and it's not a member of the EEU.
Mm-hmm.
So one asks, what is the trade identity of the Ukraine? Well, I think the figures speak on that. And they, there's a fork in the road. They'll have to choose one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. That's a whole nother program, of course. And probably that lies at the heart of many of the core issues that we discuss, or we dance around without actually attacking them, with Ukraine, the whole Ukraine issue. But let's move on now, please, and explain to me and to listeners, what is ASEAN, this Association of Southeast Asian Nations?
Well, this is a grouping of a number of countries within Southeast Asia that are not the primary drivers in Asia. There does not include India or China, but it does include strong growth economies such as Singapore, Thailand, Vietnam, Myanmar, Malaysia, and so on. Look, there's strength in numbers. And this is what the attempt is to create good trading and a good trading environment, a good interrelationship environment economically between these countries, be able to stand up for their trading rights within that area.
So it's basically kind of south, a swathe of countries and skirting the south of China, if you like, between China and India and Australasia. It's that sort of middle southern Asian block of countries then.
Yes. And look, there are also political difficulties, as with any group of nations. And it's become an either-or situation. Who is more influential with ASEAN? Is it the United States in so-called protecting the interests in the South China Sea of countries such as Vietnam, et cetera, against the so-called Chinese encroachment?
Right.
So this is a political
And yet
issue.
It doesn't include countries like Japan or the Philippines, which would be more, they would support more of a pro-U.S. stand in that particular issue that you just mentioned.
Well, again, you know, guns and butter or economics and butter, either way, people got to eat. And these associations
whatever turns
are the,
you on.
and these associations are the butter that allows things to go smoothly.
Okay, so again, looking at it extremely simply, we're talking about blocks of countries which have done away with tariffs between each of those member countries which you just mentioned, enabling them to trade freely with each other. And although you've said on a couple of occasions already this is not a political union, there are political issues, which means politics do come into it. Basically, those two blocks of countries see the world in similar ways, not the same way. I'm talking about the countries within each bloc, but it allows them to come together at least on trade. And this is a good thing, probably, in today's world.
Well, that's the beginning of any sort of a diplomatic success story.
Yeah.
The thing is that the economic self-interests of all of these groups, the EEU and ASEAN, are very similar. Politics aside, there's the issue of what role can they play outside of corridors of influence?
Yeah.
Be that corridor of influence, let's say the U.S. foreign policies through the U.S. dollar, or the Chinese foreign policies through the growing yuan.
I'd like to talk about de-dollarization and there's a more, well, not technical, but pragmatic aspects of this in a minute after our short break. But before the break, the final question, please. We've already stated that these two blocks of countries are in different parts of the world. But if you look at the map, if you look at the map of the planet, if you were to join up the two blocks, you would in fact have a swathe of countries sweeping right across half of the planet, starting on the east coast of the continent, Russian-Chinese continent, and finishing way over, really in the, almost in the heart of Europe. This is a very potentially massively important agreement that you are talking about here. If these countries do come together, at least on trade, we're looking at a different political, economic map of the world, are we not?
Yes, certainly. It won't happen tomorrow.
Yeah.
But as again, as with de-dollarization, the trend has begun.
Yeah.
The self-interest of nations is coming more and more to the forefront. It used to be that America, post-war for the past 70 years, has played the role of the good guy. Anything America did was bright, sunny, and wonderful.
Well, absolutely.
Until
white wicker gate in the sun, Sunday afternoon sunshine.
Until we've had a bit of a change in the landscape of information. thanks to the internet, thanks to the digital world.
Mm-hmm.
The word disruptor is really quite appropriate because it opened an entire Pandora's box. We call it fake news, alternative news, mm-hmm. real news. Good Lord, it's all news. It's up to us to do what some in the so-called press-repressed countries to read between the lines and find your truth.
Okay, but are there enough common interests here between these two blocks to create an atmosphere that would enable these two blocks to come together? Because we're talking about, in a way, of an eastern bloc, a really eastern bloc of countries, and a kind of a bloc which is somehow between Western Europe and Asia. It's sort of somewhere in between, bit Asia, bit Asian, and a bit European. A bit like Russia, really, isn't it?
You know? There are major mindset
differences here, aren't there? You're talking really big mindset differences.
Huge.
Is there enough common ground for them to be able to create a universal environment in which they can work in?
Well, each of them sees advantages in it, mm-hmm. and that's already half the battle. You're quite right. Culturally, they're as dissimilar as oil and vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
But the self-interests are very common. And one of the things that bind people's voting blocks or cultures together is a common challenge. I won't say an enemy or anything, but a common challenge. Mm-hmm. And increasingly over the past 20 years, the challenge has been how to get out from under the domination of the U.S. dollar.
That's our next subject, and we're going to tackle that right after a short break. Welcome back to Pivot to Asia program. My name is John Harrison. Today I'm talking with Paul Goncharov, an American businessman working in Russia, about a possible free trade agreement to be signed between the EU and ASEAN in November of this year. Now, Paul, we just began talking about perhaps the most crucial factor involved in all these negotiations, potential talks between two major trading blocks in the world, and that is the issue of de-dollarization. Now, you've kind of pitched it in a way that you're saying that this is the key issue. Is it the key issue?
One could say it is. Yeah, it is a key issue.
A key issue or and the key issue?
It is a major
key
issue.
A major issue. Okay.
Why? Because it expresses other issues. But at the mm-hmm. end of the day, follow the money. And the money today, I mean, if you believe what the Bank for International Settlements says, and I do, I have no reason not to, today 80% of all global trade is contracted in U.S. dollars.
Yeah.
80%. Now, what the other 20 is what? Is that euros and yen and and other insignificant others.
Well, what about the pound? That's not insignificant.
Well,
excuse me, I'm going to stand up and sing the British national anthem in a minute. You didn't mention the glorious pound sterling.
And a few years back, okay. I would have.
Right.
I would have. But let's look at the metrics today. This hasn't, as by the way, is what you said is very pertinent. It's fundamental. It's not a technical indicator. It's a fundamental indicator that countries, nations, are individuals. It can be described with certain characteristics, and one of them is the feeling of being snubbed or being not advised mm-hmm. with or not listened to. And this estrangement has become very apparent over the past three American presidential mm-hmm. administrations vis-a-vis partners in the world, either close allies, economic partners, or partners who'd rather not have relations with,
yeah.
which seems to be, that list seems to be growing. And it's, again, it's a carrot and a stick, where really the currency, the default currency of the world has become and is the U.S. dollar. And that's prompted many countries, well, Russia didn't have much of a choice. It's been sanctioned into a corner. Mm. So it has to do its trade outside the dollar corridor. China, the same. Iran, same.
Okay, I've had people on this program and we talked about these issues a number of occasions, and they've all basically said that, yes, if these countries come together and start trading in a different currency, it won't be mostly their own currency. They won't be trading in Turkish lira or in, in Vietnamese, whatever they're using.
Dong.
Thank you. In Vietnam. They'll be trading in yuan or some other large huge international currency. It won't necessarily be their own currency. But their argument has always been that actually it doesn't make a lot of difference because 80% is still 80%. And even the massive amounts of currency that exchange, you know, between the rand, if you replace all that with another currency, it's still not going to make a lot of difference to that 80%. Just the sheer amount of volume of currency and transactions that are carried out in US dollars makes it almost impossible. And this is the argument that I'd like to pitch to you, and you can tell me if I'm right or wrong. Even if these countries come together, that still we're still going to be living in a US dollar-dominated world.
Absolutely. And as an American, there's a part of me, a large part of me, says, well, thank God.
Right.
And we've done a good enough job for 78-plus years. Well, we continue. However, one has to take a worldview. You know, there is a thing, the parallax phenomenon. If you're looking at a single object and you move a few degrees to the right or left, the background changes. The object may not, but its context is different. The context of the U.S. dollar in the world is changing rapidly. It's becoming, for the first visible time, driving the world's financial pulse through internal American political affairs. And political affairs in the United States, arguably, are driving economic indicators, such as the Federal Reserve and so on. A point of decision has to be made, and apparently one will be coming up toward the end of September, I believe it's the 24th or 25th, with the next Fed meeting. Will they continue tightening, making the dollar more expensive, draining dollar availability in global banks? In other words, playing havoc with, let's take ASEAN, for instance, or the EEU, playing havoc with their national currencies.
Yeah, which have become dollar dependent to a
very much
large extent.
So, because we've had a dollar that was literally given away for nothing. But it's such low interest rates that it was absurd, even to negative interest rates or zero, what they call ZERPs and NERPs.
These new trade agreements could be seen as an attempt by these countries to create a number of countries, a body of trade, which is large enough to not challenge, but at least to be able to trade in a non-dollar denomination and succeed. And that alone, not to threaten the dollar, not to bring it down, because they won't be able to, but they will at least be able to exist. In a financial sphere,
instance,
which is non-dollar.
For instance, let's take a part of ASEAN, one country, Indonesia.
Yeah.
They've taken a massive hit on their rupiah.
Yeah.
They are an oil exporter, primarily, a lot of other things, and they're fairly dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
They've taken a massive hit against the U.S. dollar. Economically now, with the quantitative tightening, or as the reality is, just draining dollars.
Yeah.
Is having a disastrous effect, not only with them, with Turkey and others, but Indonesia specifically now is very seriously and is taking steps to trade on the Shanghai Oil Exchange instead of doing the traditional petrodollar route. Now, what happens in Shanghai? Which, by the way, just a little factette, the few months that the Shanghai Oil Exchange exists, they have achieved the level of growth that it took the Brent crude price 20 years to achieve. We're living in different times in terms of speed.
Okay. I'm fascinated to know what China thinks of all this, because China isn't a member of the EU or ASEAN, as it happened, is it?
No.
It's another bloc, and yet the Chinese have their own master strategy of linking basically Asia with Europe, and that's called One Belt, One Road.
Yeah.
And there's two of them. There's one across the top of the planet. It's going to benefit Russia amazingly because it's opening up the Northern Passage, so to speak. And there's a southern one, which everybody knows about, which is going across the same geographic latitudes and hemispherical areas, if you like, but using different countries.
Absolutely.
To achieve the same thing. In a way, you could say that the EU-ASEAN possible, and that's not called a link up or anything like that, it's way, way too far away, but a possible warming of relations and economic cooperation. This could be seen as kind of a competition, could it not? With the Chinese OBOR.
Well, it could be seen that way, but one thing you have to give credit to China. They're immensely practical.
Yeah.
Their diplomacy is do business, which again, and I repeat it, is the root of all political diplomacy. First of all, you've got to have a trade basis.
Yeah.
And they're doing that, regardless of political overtones, regardless if you like what China does or not in any one of a number of fields. They're doing business.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
They're not evangelizing to anybody. So here we have China, I would say, as a third party.
right.
that benefits from all these associations, the One Belt, One Road, the EEU, mm-hmm. ASEAN, they are all on or close to the borders of China.
Right, so China wouldn't take offense at the fact that there's a new sort of super international
I think they would only welcome it.
And they would try to cooperate then, that their existing sort of strategy to link it up with this new possible...
I believe so.
Okay, let's go back to this possible link up. Now, $5,061.5 question actually is this likely to happen or not? I mean, I read that there's a conference coming up in November in Singapore, and these documents, there are documents being prepared for a possible signature agreement between leaders of these two trading blocs. Is this likely to happen, Paul?
I look at it this way. This is not a new idea. It's been in the works for a number of years mm-hmm. and fits and starts. But we've reached a point now where a lot of rumors are flying around. Now, I'm a trader, not trade, you know, T-R-A-D-E-R.
Okay.
And I do listen to rumors. And there is a certain frequency hits, there's something cooking.
Yeah.
It's gone on long enough. And we're at an inflection point where either fish or cut bait, as the saying goes. And I believe that... when Putin arrives to Singapore, I believe that he will be presented documents to be signed mm-hmm. to make it official. And that's, I think, what is it, the 24th of November? Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see.
Well,
it would be in the interests of Russia. It would be, well, being a member of the EEU, and the interests of ASEAN to get the show on the road.
Yeah. And the reason this is happening, I guess, and we have to reflect on what you've said during this very program, is because of, I guess, the anger of some of these countries, which has come about because of very tight Fed policy in terms of dollar distribution around the world, which is causing havoc. Not only in Indonesia, I gather, in quite a few other countries. And so this is really the main reason, isn't it? This is happening. And this is another bucket load of evidence saying that America is just shooting itself in the foot in terms of its foreign policy, its trade, of its international trade agreement policy.
That's the truth. That is the bottom line truth. Mm. As an American here, I worry. And I'm a bit alarmed about where our foreign policy is going, economically and politically as well. I mean, how much can you sanction the world?
Mm-hmm.
How much can you add tariffs to the world when you can abrogate agreements such as NAFTA? Whether you like it or not, these are formal accepted agreements.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I understand that doing foreign policy on testosterone may make good press, but it plays havoc with balances that have been crafted diplomatically mm-hmm. throughout the world. I don't think that, I mean, we're talking about the British pound in England. I don't think, and pardon the expression, that the citizens of England are very happy campers involved in this ping pong between the EU, Brexit, United States, who gets what. Where, this has become a total muddle.
Well, it's not really their problem anymore, because
yeah.
the British people think and do. I'm sorry, you know, we might have an independent newspaper signing 1.6 million, getting 1.6 million signatures for another referendum, but will that actually happen or not? That's a different case, you know. I mean, it looks as though it's out of our hands, but just go back to the issue in hand.
Yeah.
And that is the whole point of confrontation. I mean, do you think in a way that there's more chance now of America being forced into a corner like it's forcing other countries into a corner, economically at least? Do you think there's more chance of America, the American leadership saying, well, God, you know, like, what are we going to do now? You know, we've isolated half the world. What we can do now is have another good war, not a cold war and not an economic war, but a hot war. I mean, I think it's, all these things are creating the chance of all that.
Well, look, let's, you know, as a student, I like history. And my God, we've had so many examples of substantially similar throughout mankind.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I don't mean to sound frivolous about this, but it does clean the slate.
It cleans the slate, yeah, absolutely.
And it changes the trajectories of countries.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, you know, if we're talking about the boots on the ground, that's not going to work when you've got players such as China, Russia. It makes things complicated.
I brought that subject up. We're going to finish the program. We don't have time, but I brought that subject up because we are literally talking about another world. And the, just the mere fact that these countries can have the audacity to dare to get up and challenge the usual means of transactions is in itself a quite revolutionary step.
It is, and quite indicative of the trend that we're on.
Yeah. So this possible free trade agreement between the EU and ASEAN, which may be signed in November, may not be signed, but if it is signed, and you watchers out there, you people who follow the developments of the world in terms of financial and economic strategies, as opposed and linked to the political developments that are happening at the same time, please take note. This is probably one of the most important events coming up. And I'd like to thank Paul Goncharov, an American businessman working in Russia, for pointing this out and for coming to talk to us today and enlightening us on many of these issues. Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you, listeners, for being with us today. Please do tune in again next week. Goodbye.